my loves. It's your girl, E. And this is the season 3 finale of The Call, where we hear from wildly inspiring and dynamic women about their journey to answer their life's calling. I don't know about y'all, but this season has flown by to me. We've heard from so many amazing women, and I hope you've been just as inspired as I have. So I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do for the season finale, and out of the blue, I got an email from the team of Sarah Jones. Sarah is a Tony Award-winning, Obie Award-winning performer and writer, known for the multi-character, one-person Broadway hit Bridge and Tunnel, which was originally produced by Meryl Streep, and her current critically acclaimed show, Sell By Date. Now, I had tried to get her on the show on season 1, and scheduling just didn't work out. I maybe reached out one more time, and then when we weren't able to make it happen, I just kind of let it go and didn't think anything of it. And now here we are at the end of season 3, and her team is reaching out to me. Sarah's amazing show, Sell By Date, is opening again in LA on September 27th, and she wanted to come by The Call to chat. Now, friends of mine over at the ad agency 72 and Sunny here in LA had been talking about maybe doing a live event at some time in the future, and this felt like the perfect time. For a couple reasons. One, Sarah's gift deserves to be experienced live. And coincidentally, the team at 72 and Sunny already loves Sarah. The problem was, I only had 1 week to make this happen. It wasn't the absolute best date. It was a Wednesday at 5:30 in Playa Vista. And if you know anything about LA, that's not really a great time for an event. But I decided to go for it. And sure enough, 2 weeks ago, we held our very first live taping of The Call. Sarah performed a brilliant excerpt from Sell By Date in the most gorgeous space imaginable, and the audience loved it. My favorite moment, though, was after the event. I was walking in my car, and a security guard who worked at the facility came up to me and started talking about his dreams and his passions and his life story and the things in his life that he'd been putting off pursuing. He was inspired by hearing our conversation now to all of a sudden go for it. In that moment, I was really, really glad that I didn't give in to my fear and that I hosted the event anyway. And here's why I did it. See, it's something I've been wanting to do for a while, get some members of The Call community together in person, but I was trying to wait until everything was perfect. But I'm trying to also practice the art of just doing it, not waiting for things to be perfect, like we heard from Glennon Doyle.
I don't know how to write a book. I have no idea how to write a book. All I know is that I know how to sit my butt down in a chair and not move for 2 hours and make my fingers move. If I do that enough times, magically there's a book.
There's a book there. Right.
But if I tell myself I need to write a book, this has happened to me for the last 6 months. I haven't been able to write a thing. It's because I've been big thinking and freaking myself out.
Or not waiting for things to be easy, like we heard from Dasha Polanco.
And I was like, this is hard and I can't be doing this. I have to just like stick to my job, finish my nursing, and then maybe later on I'll continue to do it. And I remember at that time, this audition for Orange came in so unexpected. I had just said, you know what, focus on managing this hospital and managing the other one. Make your money, save it, and do what you have to do and just give that a break. He calls me and he starts like screaming static on the phone. You booked it. You don't understand. Your life is going to change.
Not waiting to feel like you look the best or you have the dream body like we heard from Jamila Jamil.
We've forgotten to ask ourselves who we are. We don't know who we are. We just care about what we look like.
Or not waiting to feel like we're 100% ready and qualified like we heard from Janet Mock.
And so I was like, holy shit, this is like a white man's job. Like even in my own head, I was like, right. Can I do this, right?
I just wanted to do the thing that the show is all about. Answer a call, take a step, make something happen, no matter how big or small or scary. And that's the message that I hope you took away from this entire season and from every conversation we've had here on The Call. This past week, a stylist and fashion influencer that I'd only ever seen on Instagram, Kirsaida Rodriguez, passed away of stage 4 stomach cancer. Other than the fact that she was beautiful and had the best haircut I'd ever seen, I didn't know that much about her before I started seeing all the tributes rolling in about her death. So as one does on the internet, I went down a rabbit hole, learning all about her life and how she was brave enough to quit her job in her 30s and pursue her passion, and how she used her platform as it grew and as she became more successful, not just to show off her beautiful sense of style, but to inspire others, even as she was dying of cancer, to live a better life. So I want to leave you with a message from Kirsaida from her very last Instagram Live. She was in a hospital bed on oxygen, leaving what would end up being her final message to her community and her fans. She was talking about how in the end, the thing that matters most is what you did with your life, not what you had. And if there's something in you that you really want to do, well, I'll let her take it from here.
Go. Do it. Don't wait for another day or another hour or another time. Go and do it now.
Yeah. Don't wait until you hear 10 more podcast episodes and or until you think things are perfect or until you have the right partner or apartment or job. Do the thing that's in your heart to do. Answer the call that's been tugging at you. Sarah Jones did it. She knew that she'd never be cast to be all the characters that were inside of her, so she made her own one-woman show. Let's all, in our own ways, be brave enough to make our own one-woman show. So this episode goes out to Cressida and you, my brave, fierce, loyal listeners. Thanks for another great season. And here is Sarah Jones and her many characters on The Call.
Hello. Thank you, Erica, for that. That was so lovely. Can you hear me all right? It's sort of like ringy in my ears, but if you're all right, I'm okay. You all right? Yeah? Lovely. So thank you for that. That was fantastic. I want to just quickly say my name is Sarah Jones. You got that part too, so we hit you there. I recently came to LA from New York, and when I had the opportunity to be here. I'm doing this show. It starts September 27th. It runs into November. And we're, you know, trying to sort of meet people and make them aware of the show in case they might enjoy it. And I thought, but I'm new here and oh, I don't know anybody. Oh, what could I possibly have to say? Oh. And I thought, you know, maybe like a really sort of reassuring sounding English accent might help things a bit. And then I just thought like, no, you know, I just have to like get up there and just be myself and just be authentic. You know, it's 72 and sunny and advertising is all about like figuring out how to like tell story, but also you really want to be authentic and, you know, like transparent. Anyway, so I portray people of various different backgrounds in the theater. That's what I do. And now I do that in television and in film, and I've been I'm really fortunate. I did a one-woman show on Broadway called Bridge and Tunnel, and that launched me into doing these characters. So all of my characters come from my real background. My family members, I come from a multicultural family. I am clearly black from a distance, and I'm also a person of multicultural descent. So on my mother's side, my grandmother was Irish-American and German-American. There are both Christians and Jews on that side of the family. It's a long story filled with intrigue and interfaith guilt. And on my dad's side, and my, I also have my grandfather's from the Caribbean. We have Dominicans on that side. My my father's family, African-American from the South, and some Caribbean roots in there. So basically, you shake my family tree and, you know, everything falls out and starts fighting. No, no. It's a very multi-culti story, and I grew up with that being normal. And so I just, this lady here was at my Thanksgiving table, totally normal, and she would say, Sarah, honey, why do you call yourself black? You know, you're really more like a caramel color. So I stole it, and I sometimes change the names to protect the innocent and especially the guilty, but that's where all of these folks come from. So hi, good afternoon, good evening. I don't even know what time it is anymore. My name is Nereida. I'm very excited to be here. Sarah Jones told me that we are coming, and I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. I wanted to briefly just introduce myself. My name is Praveen Manvi. It's wonderful to meet all of you here. I am only taking a moment now. I don't want to speak very at length, but I am also in the show of Sell By Date. So my name is Bella. I was named for like Bella Abzug, who's like a famous like feminist from like history. And like, I feel that like, you know, this is a time for like people to be like woke on a level that's like beyond woke, like post-woke woke. All right, so I hope you'll stick around for some podcasting because that's what's about to happen with this amazing woman. And away we go.
So wait, how many characters did you just do? That was
So I just did, I don't know, that was maybe five or six.
And how many are in the show?
In the in this show, there are 19.
That's yes. A lot.
Yes, I'm a lot. I'm divorced for a reason.
Oh.
But I mean, it wasn't, you know.
It wasn't because
it wasn't his fault.
Was it because, well, I thought you were going to say it wasn't because of the voices.
Yeah, it was. Probably was. It was. I didn't have good boundaries.
Awesome.
I wasn't
all right.
Good at, yeah.
We're going to start the show. Sarah, thank you so much for being here
thank
on the call.
Thank you for having me, Erica.
I'm really
on
happy.
The
and
call.
Thank y'all for being here.
Yeah.
So I want to jump in and talk about this show, Sell by Date, and then from there, really want to kind of dig into the person and the journey that you took that got you to this point where you are 19 characters on a stage. So tell me the premise of Sell by Date. Kind of what is the frame and the foundation of the actual story you're telling through these characters?
Yeah, so I have been performing, you know, characters of different backgrounds, like basically all my life. I do come from a multicultural family, and I picked up on all these different, you know, I have relatives who talk like this at the table, and I would have to kind of figure it out and give it back to them, you know, and I also have the ones who sound like this, and they sit across from each other, and one says, oh my God, this food is too spicy, and the other one says, oh my God, it's so bland, it's a crime against food. And so I had to learn how to navigate all of that space, and that's kind of where my characters originate. And I knew that I wanted to make some kind of impact in my one small individual way on the narratives that I was seeing. You know, we all of us, I mean, I grew up with film and television that was not representative of people like me or families like mine. Mm-hmm. Anytime we saw a mixed family, we gathered around, like it was like, you know, we were like, it's a lot. You know, we couldn't believe that that other families that looked like ours even existed. Mm-hmm. And so now, thank God, it's changed, but I just remember thinking, if I ever get the chance, I want to tell stories from the perspectives of people who are normally marginalized on TV or in film and on stage in theater. And so Sell by Date in particular grew out of conversations about women and women's empowerment and sex and sexuality, mm-hmm. and, you know, Beyonce feminism, right? Like, I'm a feminist and I'm powerful and I still get to shake my ass. And in fact, that's a part of my feminism. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a different, you know, kind of version of strength and empowerment than I had heard in my women's college.
What had you heard in your women's college?
I think what I heard in my women's college was more like down with the patriarchy, and if I wear red lipstick, I'm participating in the patriarchy. There was a lot of that. And I understood why, right? Mm-hmm. But like getting to claim my power as a woman, as a, you know, like fully integrated self who has a sexual self and wants to engage with the world and cares about aesthetics and beauty. I like lipstick.
Right.
Can I still, you know, march with Planned Parenthood and, you know, demand my rights? Yes. So I wanted to look at all of that. And specifically, I had seen a couple of plays and, you know, different stuff in different media about prostitution, you know, what people call sex work, or basically, do we call it commercial sexual exploitation? Do we call it empowering, you know, women being entrepreneurs and using their bodies? What do we call that? Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to talk about it. I wanted to unpack it for myself. When I was in college, I was like, oh, stripping, that, you know, I can do it. I'm a feminist. I can be like an ironic stripper and, you know, I'll put like pasties over my nipples that have Che Guevara on them or, you know, like whatever.
Right.
And I really wanted to look at all of that. And I couldn't find a play that didn't make me want to slit my wrists at the end. It was very much like dark and heavy and super painful. And it's a huge, challenging topic, but I wanted to feel human about it and mm-hmm. not... anyway, my goal was to talk about sexual exploitation, prostitution, all of the, you know, porn, just all of it.
Yeah.
And still have people have a good time at the theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that the only way I could really talk about it the way I wanted to was to set it in the future. And so the piece is set in the future. Kind of like, you know, it's a lot easier to go see Django in chains and then leave and not actually be in chains.
Yeah.
you know what I mean?
Do you think about the future a lot? Like, are you the kind of person who, you know, is always future looking, forward thinking, or are you more, I prefer to stay in the present, live in the now?
Yeah.
Where do you fall?
On my good days, I can be very present. I'm very meditative. I have a lot of that going on. But I think I am hardwired, you know, this reptilian brain is cranking away with like, let's be vigilant. What's coming? What's happening in a week? What's happening next year? There is that. And I like the storytelling aspect of like predictive, you know, like we can actually course correct when we think about where we're heading based on where we are now, right? So if I look carefully and mindfully, like you're saying, being in the present and being in the now at what my trajectory is, mm-hmm. then I can influence the future. So, but I love that. I love the idea of like, if I'm present, I actually have some power over what the future, you know, how the future will be shaped.
That's such an evolved way of looking at it all. I am not like that. So no. I no, no.
You just don't look there. You're like, let's
no.
not look.
You know
over
what?
There.
I think most of my life I was obsessed with the future. Like I started off always thinking about the future. Like I can control it. I can plan it.
Oh no,
this
that
is what I want.
Work.
Right?
Yeah, you needed
so
me. I could.
You start
work.
Like phase
work.
A. I'm gonna plan my future. Then you realize, well, that ain't gonna work, sis. Right. So after that, we're gonna okay.
How did you know that it wasn't gonna work? Did you get like?
Well, because you plan things and then they don't happen. That's pretty much how life operates.
But what if, so, and here, now let me ask you this, because this is what happened with me. I would plan things and then they would happen. And I would get this sort of out, you know, this like really unrealistic sense of, I really can.
Yeah.
You know, and what I realized was I was getting what I wanted.
Yes.
But that's very different from getting what I needed.
Yes, and I would also argue that getting what you want is different than having than a plan, right?
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
I would notice that there would be things that I would gravitate towards, things that I would desire, and sometimes those would happen, right?
Yeah.
But when I sit down and I'm like, this is going to happen at this date, on at this time in my life, I'm going to be here by this point.
Oh,
here.
Oh, yeah, that's not a, yeah, that's
it don't
not,
work.
That's not a thing.
Mm-mm. Nope. So then I went through phase where I'm like, I'm not thinking about the future. You yeah. can't control it. Yeah. It's gonna happen. I'd rather be in the now. And I kind of all, I just vacillate back and forth
oh, that's
all the time.
Still now you find that you move back
still,
and forth.
Still now.
I think that's me too. And I think the fun thing about characters, so I, part of the reason these guys all evolved was, I didn't want to be present. I had a really challenging childhood that looked really good on the outside. And my parents were doctors, both of them, and there was a lot of like, oh my God, you guys are, you know, magical creatures. And as it turns out, we weren't magical creatures. We just, you know, my parents were very high achieving, but also very young. They were, you know, my parents met in college as undergrads and were like, we know what to do. Let's have a baby because that'll really keep this nice and simple and great.
Right.
And so it was really challenging. And I think I needed an escape and to babysit myself because when your parents are on call. But also I started being able to really empathize in a deep way with people who didn't look like me, first of all, because they were my family members, but then even outside that, like I ended up going to the UN school in New York, and I was surrounded by people from 150 countries.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of seeing them as separate, and instead of kind of, I really felt this kinship with all of these people. And I think that started to shape a sense of safety in the present. And I think that helped me with some of the futurizing that mm-hmm, you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So when I realized, oh, wait a minute, like the universe is friendly. Like that, I think that's a general premise that I did not believe you know, earlier on. And then I started to take that on and think, okay, how would I behave if I really trusted, you know, the average person instead of looking at them, sizing them up? You know, I have a character who's, I won't put her hijab on, but she sounds like this. She is from Jordan. And I had to learn about her because she is working for girls to have their freedom where she is from. And I was so moved talking to this lady. And I realized the next time I am, you know, kind of panicking and reading the headlines, I have to remember there are so many people who are doing that heart work everywhere.
Mm. And heart work, I like
heart,
that.
Yes, this work with the heart. And that helps me because otherwise I'm in the future like, oh my God, you know, especially after the events of, you know, November 9th, was it?
2016.
November 9th. But it's like 9/11. When I say it, it's like November 9th, 2016.
You
like,
know
where
happened.
Were you on that day? But
wait, I'm curious, though. So as a storyteller
yeah.
and someone who thinks, arguably you've said you've thought a lot about the future.
Yes,
you
I have.
Pay a lot of attention to people and their stories
yeah.
and their lives. And I imagine that gives you kind of a really astute cultural analysis. Were you then surprised in September of 2016? I hate to go back there, but I'm just curious about that
well,
turning
point.
Well,
we live point. There now. So.
Right. But were you curious about that turning point? Because most folks that I knew in an intimate way, my friends, my family, many of whom are people of color, were like,
yeah.
well, yeah. Like, that's what was going to happen.
So I think I believed what, you know, people who read the news I read were believing.
Yeah.
In fact, I was performing Sell By Date at that time in New York. And I was at a splashy thing with some... There were a lot of fancy celebrities who had raised a lot of money for Hillary, and we had all, and we were all hanging out, and people were like, "Are you worried at all?" And I was like, "I'm not worried at all." I like talked to the New York Times. I was like, "I'll put my whatever it was. I'm sure it's gone now because I put my bet it away and it's gone." But I think I also, I'm not shocked. I think that there was a combination of corruption, and I mean, I really, we can call it other names, but I think it's corruption at mm-hmm. its core. The vast majority of people in this country did not vote for this person. Mm-hmm. I don't care if you look at it as the Electoral College being the problem, or if you look at it as, you know, voter suppression being the problem, or if you look at it as, you know, Russian interference. I don't care which of those things you pick to parse why it happened. It happened. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I'm not disheartened because I know that the majority of this country did not vote for this person. I know that if the votes of Puerto Rican people and people in D.C. counted, you know, the GOP right. would never win another election again. And they know that. And that is why we have the structure that we have. But it comforts me because when people are like, half the country ain't vote for that motherfucker. Come on. Please, let's be real about it. There is a rigged mess that we're all tolerating that has, you know, all kinds of problems underneath it, including, you know, campaign finance reform. There's a lot of mess mm-hmm. in the way of what this democracy is actually asking for.
Mm-hmm. Did it change the types of stories you wanted to tell?
No, I was always talking about this. I mean, I have a living memory of George W. Bush winning because of a Chad or whatever the hell that all was. That's madness. Like, we, you know, I remember thinking, like, oh, we're the United States. We're the country that, you know, we send in inspectors to countries when crazy shit like that happens. And we, you know, mm-hmm. look around and say, this is unfair. This is undemocratic. We are the U.S. We fix it for you, whatever. And now we are, like, I wish, you know, many countries would send inspectors in to look at what we are doing. Our voting machines are owned and operated by private companies that have interests in a certain party winning. I'm sorry, what? Mm-hmm. Like, that's cray-cray. So I am very clear that what we have is a deeply flawed, broken system.
Mm-hmm. That has always been that way.
That has always been this way.
Right.
We were 3/5 of people so that people's votes could count a certain way.
Right.
So we have been moving toward an actual democracy since 1770, whatever. I'm not a historian.
But here's my question for you. How do you, knowing all of that that's going on, whether or not you might think it's crazier now than it's ever been, or maybe it's more intense, or it's
more visible.
A heightened kind of awareness of what's happening and what has always been. How do you measure your own impact then as an artist? How do you say, this is what I do and this contribution is valuable?
Yeah, I don't measure because I it's none of my business. My job is to create the most compelling stories that I can, try to expose them to people who will shine a light so that people can see them. These ideas that I'm trying to put forth, and then let go of the results. I you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And of course, I'd love to have maximum impact. I think everybody who tells stories, everyone here, you know, has a gift and wants to be of service with that gift. I, as you said earlier, can't control, first of all, I sometimes can't control the means of production or my, you know, story getting out there. I try to influence that. I'm a one-person show person, so pretty much all I need is me, which does help, and I think that's by design, right? If somebody's not going to automatically cast me, and so, you know, there's not a lot of people who will automatically cast me as Mrs. Ning, the Chinese-American character I care about so much. I put her in my first show, Bridge and Tunnel. I want to hear the voice of this immigrant woman who has a daughter who is gay and wants to be married and could not at that time. I want to hear that. No one will cast me to do that, only me. So I wrote that, I put that there, and then now I feel so grateful that I met a lot of Asian families who talked to me about that. So for me, just let the art be a kind of focus and guide to decide what you will reach. I cannot control that, but I can try to, if someone say I don't want you, I pick myself. So I think that's a big part of it, is like control what I can control.
Right.
And I guess the other piece of that is learning to go where I can collaborate. I can't do it alone. I thought I could. That's why the
one-woman show
thing. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, if it's just you and no audience, that doesn't work. And so I found, I didn't do a television show because I couldn't do the creative. Somebody else takes these people who are such a part of me and rips them all apart and does all kinds of stuff. Couldn't do that, but I could do TED Talks and I can reach 6 million people that way. So
you've worked to find the mediums and the avenues that work best for what your gift is.
Yes. Rather than trying to fit it. And error. I sold a lot of pilots. I did all of that. But when I first was working, I would, people would be like, I saw your show. I love you. You're great. Blah, blah, blah. I had a lot of great luck. Meryl Streep found me. Like a baby in a bassinet. I was doing my humanitarian work. And she was, Meryl's amazing. And she was like,
no, I don't know. What do you mean? I don't know.
We don't know. We know nothing. let me get you a memo. Meryl Streep is amazing. But she was on the board, or she was, volunteering her time with a group called Equality Now, which worked on women and girls' human rights. And I had given up an MTV. There was like this show that I was going to do. And in the end, I was like, this is racist and sexist, and I can't do it. And
I've said that many times.
Don't you? How do we have any hair left, right? It's like, I'm pulling it out because it's racist.
I just got an opportunity this week, and I was like, oh, it would be so good, but it's so racist and sexist, like, I can't do it. You know?
That
happens.
That's changing. It's changing. Mm-hmm. We are changing it with our allies. Thank you. We need you. So that experience of following my calling, instead of, I was like, oh, it's fancy. I'm in LA, Chateau Marmont. I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
It was racist, sexist, I couldn't. And so I went home to New York and I was doing this humanitarian stuff that called to me and bumped into Meryl that way.
Wow.
Right? Like, I didn't go to Tisch. I didn't, I didn't go to USC. I didn't do the conventional route that you're supposed to take. I did not take that. And still something, kind of found me. And okay. So anyway, I bring that up because I feel like the opportunities that found me have shaped me as much as I have also intentionally gone out there and, quote unquote, tried to make it happen. I really think in everyone's life there's there's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then there's kind of, I hate to sound, mystical, magical about it, but there's some kind of life force. Some kind of chi, I feel, is, kind of carrying all of us so that we are as useful with our gifts as we can be.
So let's take a step back then and give me a little bit. You started talking about that journey of like, well, I didn't go the traditional route.
Right.
So rewind. You're a young girl. Yeah. You've got all these characters in the family. You are drawn to the idea of storytelling.
Yes.
What specifically, though, did you think you'd be doing or want to do?
I thought I was going to be a lawyer because my parents are doctors and you have to be a good girl.
Okay.
And at no point did I think I would, I thought these were silly voices. I would leave people's, outgoing voicemail for them. They'd be like, oh, do the... And I'd be like, Erica is not home. If you want to find her, too bad. She has gone to Moscow. Leave message after tone. Maybe she calls you back. Maybe not. Too bad. You should be a good person. Goodbye. And then, that's what I use them for. And it wasn't until I went through some personal losses, those experiences that kind of, they're soul-shaking, but the turbulence is what dislodges that sense of like, I got this, I'm fine, I'm in control, I can do everything, blah, 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 blah. The biggest gifts I've experienced are because the universe grabs me and shakes me upside down.
And it doesn't feel good though.
Feels terrible.
Right.
So unpleasant. And yet, I mentioned being divorced, that's real. And these are some of the best things that have happened to me, not because there was anything wrong with my ex-husband, but because I needed to grow up, and I couldn't do that in the relationship that I was in. And I would say that my career is really about maturing, like, and just sort of growing up, which ironically is about getting back to that play and being that little girl. So I was kind of like, you know, everything has to look good on the outside. Like, mm-hmm. I've heard this great expression, you know, comparing my insides to other people's outsides. Like, I have no idea what's in your head, but if you look good, I think I know your story. Social media is my favorite example of that, right? People's carefully curated, you know, exhibitions of their fabulousness. And meanwhile, I know a lot of those people, and if you talk to them, they're like, girl, my shit's falling apart. I'm janky as fuck. Oh, my God. Bleh. And then on their story is like, just live in Cannes. Oh, you know, and... And I get that. I mean, yeah. I do, very famous, and at home I'm like, I gotta live on the toilet, you know. So, like, really getting it that worrying about my self-image as opposed to my true self, mm-hmm. always going to be a detour that, you know, knocks me off of the course that I really want to be on. And so I had to learn that. And now maturing looks like being more available to my inner silly, you know, embarrassing, super uncool little girl. Like, I think I posted a story today. Yes, I know I did. Where I'm doing the floss, which I won't get up and do for y'all now.
Oh, no.
But yeah, I won't. No, it's not happening. That wasn't even one of those, like, I'm baiting you to go, like, come on, girl. No, it's not happening. But I put it out there because a voice in my head was like, don't you put this. And so now, whenever the more fervent that voice of be dignified, be cool, this is important, you know, what are you doing? I'm always like, I'm doing it. And it gets me outside of that comfort zone of image management,
yeah,
and into like, who am I really? I heard I have 1,000 healers and it takes a village to raise a one woman show and all that kind of shit. And this one mentor person said, a human being only needs to ask themselves 4 questions in life. Actually, she said 3 and I added 1. Who am I? Who am I? Not what does my resume say, not, you know, any of that. Where did I go to school? But who am I really? And sit still long enough to get the freaking answer. Because a lot of times, like, I don't have time for this. I have to go to the gym. That's not the answer. So who am I? Mm-hmm. How do I feel? Not I feel fat. I feel like I need, you know, not that. But like, how do I feel? Maybe there's grief here. Maybe there's, you know, maybe my grief at Kavanaugh is also, you know, about some unresolved grief from being bullied as a kid. I don't know. But like, every person here has had like this wealth of experiences, and most of us move on from them without like really understanding ourselves or like, you know, sitting still with it. So who am I? How do I feel? And in light of the honest answer to how do I feel, what do I need? Because usually I'm running to the gym or I'm running to this. I might need a hug instead of, you know, 45 minutes of cardio. I might need, you know, a brownie or not a brownie or whatever, mm-hmm. instead of whatever it is I'm telling myself is the fix. Mm-hmm. So what do I really need? And also, what do I want? Because I suffer from good girlism. It's
too.
A very pervasive
Hi,
disease,
nice
I was going
to
say.
You.
It's really nice to meet you. Yes. I usually recognize my people. Good girlism, good boyism, good personism. It's very real. And it prevents me from hearing, I'm kind of okay getting my needs met because that's the good girl thing to do. But like, what do I want? What do I desire? Like, I'm allowed to take up space. And that can be a really hard thing, I think, for all people, but especially as a woman of color. It's kind of like, I don't have any needs. I'm good. I'm going to move my neck like this. You know, like, there's a lot of like,
I do not move my neck like
that. I know. I understand. But I do. And so there's a lot of like, this is also the Dominican neck, but whatever. The point being, I get to move my neck how I want. And mm-hmm, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, really keying into what are my desires. And that will guide my work. My writing is stronger. My performance is better. I take better meetings. I turn down the meetings I don't really want. It actually is this kind of magical serum for a better everything.
Yeah. Have you ever, so you put all of that, you know, this exploration of who you are and what you want and what you need into this work and these characters that you love. You turn down opportunities that may or may not be right for you. Have you ever done all of that, created something that you love and are proud of, and then put it out in the world and it just, the reaction was not what you wanted?
It's funny because I thought I knew where you were going with the question, and I thought you were going to say, and then felt disappointed. And I was going to say, every day. Because every day I go through these kind of, I surf these waves of like, I'm so satisfied. I'm so dissatisfied. Everything's wonderful. Oh my God, fuck. You know, like I for whatever reason, and I'm sure, you know, I'm not the only person, but I have a really active emotional life that is sometimes, I have this, you know how if you're like, if you're texting, you can start typing something and it'll autocorrect to something very, very wrong. Mm-hmm. And like I have this joke that if I start typing the word abundance, it converts into a burden. And like there are times in my life where the most wonderful thing, you know, I won a Tony or whatever, I went to have the most wonderful things happen to me and I feel terrible. And I couldn't explain to anyone, right? You guys probably think I'm nuts. Like that sounds really crazy. But for whatever reason, the way I grew up, it was like, you know, don't get too big for your britches. Like, and even though my parents were encouraging, so I don't even know where I got this from, but there was this message of like, too much good is not okay. Like, And so to this day, I have to get outside my comfort zone to receive the maximum abundance. And when I'm not aware, I can push away. I can't even tell you the stuff I've turned down, run away from. And some of it, I've heard it called fear of success or whatever. But I think that I've learned that just because I feel lousy doesn't mean my life, like I can feel terrible and my life can be amazing. And my life can look, you know, objectively on paper, not as great. Like I was in the middle of, you know, a divorce and all this stuff. And I was like, I feel pretty great. I feel pretty complete. I'm kind of a good person. Like I said, what? And yes, it's therapy and all the things. But, you know, it's possible. It is true for me that my life circumstances and the conventional, you know, thought of like what your circumstances should look like, the boxes that you tick off, the, you know, the car, the guy, the blah, blah, blah. Those things can all be in place and I can have a crisis of faith in myself and in life. And none of those things can be in place and I can feel, you know, sort of miraculously whole and connected. And it's like the weather.
Yep, it changes.
It changes.
So what does success look like for you? And actually, let me ask you this. What did you think it was when you were, let's say 20 years ago?
Yeah.
What did you think success was going to be and how has that changed?
One thing that's changed for me is I don't feel like I have to be, you know, like my parents in terms of like, you know, doctors, multiple degrees, all of this stuff. I really, like, I actually didn't finish. I went to Bryn Mawr and I didn't finish. And I had all of this angst about
it. Why didn't you finish? What happened?
First of all, this is not Bryn Mawr's fault, but I was bored because I was kind of like, oh my God, I miss New York. And there, you know, Bryn Mawr is a small women's college near Philadelphia. And I also was going through like a really challenging transition as a young woman. Like my family, my parents got divorced and I was like just feeling really irritable all the time and like, you know, disconnected from the learning process that I was supposed to be there for. And what that translated to was, what time's the party? When do we get to the party? What time we start drinking? Who's got the weed? Like, I was basically just like, this is not fun. I am bored. I would like to party, please. And there was lots of like fun hip hop stuff. You know, there was like, I knew people in New York. I could just like roll up to parties and have fun. And so I won't tell you about the time I got a ride home from Biggie Smalls, but I did. So,
I think you should probably tell us about
that. About
that,
right? Yeah. So that was, I was obviously I didn't have to show ID to get in the club, but I got in the club and, actually Talib Kweli told this story on some other podcast or something. And I was like, I think I hate this. And then I was like, I probably have to own it. So now I'm re-owning it. He was like, Biggie had a crush on Sarah Jones. Biggie also had crushes on many, many people. Let's be clear. This does not make me a special person. But yeah, I was leaving a club with my friend and he was like, y'all need a ride back to Brooklyn. And I was like, yeah, we need a ride back to Brooklyn.
What?
And so we rode back to Brooklyn in Biggie's, whatever that was, Escalade or something.
I might have dropped out of college too if that was my Friday night.
Those were my Friday nights when I wasn't at Bryn Mawr thinking about like, you know, Greek anthropology. And like, so anyway, all of this to say, I thought success would look like a certain kind of, you know, endless satisfaction and joy. Like that when you arrive, when you get the cash and prizes and you've, you know, again, ticked off all the boxes, you will experience some sort of perfect, you know, line into the future.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that the people I was, you know, sort of idolizing from afar live very human lives. They drive Teslas and they, you know, whatever, but they also have, you know, problems and they call me for help with their problems. And so I think I misunderstood that I thought the human experience is about the endless pursuit of perfect happiness and then like catching it and, you know, attaching to it and going to your grave like this. I found it. I'm happy all the time. And that's not a real thing. So now I understand I am successful. You're successful. We're all successful. And we get to self, you know, we get to sort of self-identify as successful people in whatever ways make sense to us.
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was growing up, I thought for me, success, there were a lot of things, but one of it, stability.
Yeah.
I assume that similar to you, that you find a thing.
Yeah.
And then that's the thing.
How do you define stability? Like, do you mean like sort of home life and
just that everything, once you find, like that you work really hard to find a thing, achieve something, and then from there, I don't even know if I envisioned beyond that.
Right.
It's just like, then life just works out after that, whatever that is.
Happily ever after.
Yeah.
I mean, in fairness, we were fed this mythology, so we didn't just
We were fed those narratives. But then I think in terms of now, you know, when you said we're all successful, I think we all have the ability to define what success means to us. But I think I fail a lot, right?
Yes. Do you know Pema Chodron, the Buddhist teacher? So she has that book, Fail Better. What is it? Fail.
I don't know the name of the book.
I'm failing now in telling you the title of the book. And she would approve. Because the whole point is that in our lives, the fear of failure prevents us from, you know, trying or living authentically or whatever it is. And whereas if we sort of accept failure as something that doesn't have an automatic, you know, negative connotation, but is instead part of I used to joke that, like, I didn't drop out of Bryn Mawr. I deferred indefinitely to pursue a course of nonlinear lifelong learning. So that's what, you know, failure is a part of that, what we call failure, right? Like, you could say if you attempt to run a mile and you have to stop at, you know, the half mile mark, you failed to run that mile. That's one way of putting it. But I would say you ran half a fucking mile and, you know, now you will get up and you'll run again and you'll do. So I think it's about how we contextualize it and how we want to feel. And I'm not one of those people who's like, you're a snowflake if you're telling yourself you didn't fail. I don't know why I'm suddenly a bad Southern. I don't know what that is. But I'm going with it.
You're a terrible snowflake if you need to soften things for yourself just to feel okay.
And I would say, actually, you are a revolutionary if you are able to, you know, soften around your goals enough to realize that goals are meaningful and the living that it takes to pursue those goals is the most meaningful thing. Mm-hmm. So I think there's that.
So what do you say to someone who is, let's say, like a younger Sarah, who has, you know, kind of a picture of what they think life is supposed to look like, but does feel compelled to do something different? There's, you know, whether they're a storyteller or an artist of some kind or doctor, architect, I don't care what it is, but is trying to figure out that journey and is pretty clear at this point that it's not going to be very straightforward. It might be messy, particularly in this climate. I don't know anyone's life that is straightforward now. Right. What
you
advice?
You don't hang out in D.C., do you?
I'm from there.
But you don't hang out there now.
Not anymore.
I'm kidding. I was thinking like their lives, right? Like some people know that they're going to go to Mar-a-Lago tomorrow and then they're going to go to another golf club the next day. That's not the life I want. Right.
Right.
But people who live that life endanger me. But anyway,
what do you tell that person?
I would tell that person, first of all, there's a great phrase that I've heard, that my life, I always thought that life was about like making things better and especially feeling better. Right. I think that's a lot of messaging in our culture. Like, here's a pain reliever. Here's a, you know, if things are bumpy, like fix it, you know, give that kid a bowl of ice cream. Stop, don't cry. Oh God. And what I've discovered is that my life is not about, and this is a phrase that I got from someone else, so please don't credit me with it. My life is not about feeling better. It's about getting better at feeling whatever is here. So feeling my grief better, feeling my, you know, frustration better, feeling my joy better, like whatever it is, like you said earlier, really getting present. Like what's here? Because I'm running, I'm taking flight from myself all day without realizing it. And that's human. Like we are hardwired to like scan the perimeter for like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful sunny day. Oh my God, what is that? You know, like you can't help it. It's just how we're wired.
Yeah.
And yet with practice,
we can, you know, forge new neural pathways. Like, we can actually grow new dendritic branches. I love the word dendritic, and I say it whenever I can.
That's amazing.
But we can, you know, whatever's been colonized in our brains that makes us fearful and, you know, tells us we're not okay, I would tell that younger version of myself, this is okay. Like, oh, but I'm not following my calling. You're okay. Mm-hmm. Like, stay in today. What can you do right now that would be generous and loving to yourself? I didn't get the job. Take a bubble bath. But I'm going to fail. Have a sandwich. You know, like, I would just tell that person, stay in today. Stay connected with other people who are moving in their lives toward what you want, who you really trust. Ask them for help. Oh, my God. If I could have told myself that asking for help is not only safe, but it is vital. Mm-hmm. And that when I ask for help, I strengthen myself such that I can then be someone who others can ask for help. It's huge.
See, that right there for me is the end part of what you said resonated the most, because I have a very difficult time doing the let me just take care of me, let me just get in touch with my feelings for the sake of doing that. If I can't connect it to how it's going to make a difference, make an impact, help someone else, drive me forward. And I will at some point go to therapy for that, yes, Sarah. But but I bring that up because I actually do think they're connected, right? I've
Absolutely.
Seen so many people who are not in alignment with who they are and then are showing up in all kinds of ways that are just messing things up for everybody else.
Yes.
So there actually is, there is a really important connection there.
I would argue that there's no disconnect. Like, that is one, there's sort of one organism that is, I think, you know, I really do believe in sort of, we are all part of a collective consciousness, right? So if I think I'm showing up for you, but I'm not, you can feel that. And even if you don't feel it consciously, energetically, but I have this idea that we are all exchanging something that, you know, maybe in the future, in my play in the future, we discover in the same way that people didn't know there were microwaves years ago, and now we can use them and harness them to cook delicious things. There are waves of energy that we're exchanging. And it's why I read this fascinating thing that in urban areas, this was specifically New York, but I'm sure it's LA too, even if people have tons of money, they suffer disproportionate anxiety, you know, from being in close proximity to other people who are suffering, poor, homeless, whatever it is. Yeah. Our proximity alone to other people's suffering creates suffering for us, whether we realize it or not. It's like happening on an energetic level, right? So if you're not filling your own well, and you think you're filling somebody else's, really everybody's getting depleted. It's also not our fault. It's not a moral issue. We're not bad people because we run around trying to help everybody else and we're not taking care of ourselves. It's what we're taught in our culture. Mm-hmm. And then we gradually unlearn it, even if it's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. Like you, mm-hmm. I guess what I would say is, because we're all strong enough and we have that, you know, such high thresholds for discomfort that we're like, no, really, it's fine. Yep, I'll be at your wedding. Yep, I know I have to, you know, like write a play and finish it and blah, blah, but I'll be there. Because we're so good at that, if we know how to tolerate suffering, we can start to tolerate the suffering that's, I'm so uncomfortable taking care of myself. This sucks so bad. I just need to go help somebody right now. You can withstand that long enough to build up the muscle of like, oh, I'm going to take care of me so that I can mm-hmm. be there for you, but not only so that I can be there for you. I also deserve just to take care of me because it's intrinsically important because I matter. And if I believe I matter, I can take my place in this larger organism and be, again, I use service all the time because it helps me get out of my head.
That was very good advice from me. What's next? What's next for you?
What's next? So I am working on a television thing that I cannot tell you about just yet. I'm going to be in, there's a Noah Baumbach movie that's coming up that I am excited about that I'm in. There's, I love Broad City, love those ladies, and this is their last season, and I'll be in that. There's a bunch of things. I would just say, if people want to follow my socials, which I try not to be on too much, but I am on there still, that's a good place to find out what I'm doing. Yeah. And, I'm looking forward to these. This is a wonderful group of beings.
Sarah, thank you. Thank you so, so very much.
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you all for being here.
Isn't she amazing, y'all? I told you. If you want to see her and you happen to be here in LA, make sure to check out Sell By Date, which opens on September 27th. Sarah, thank you so much for coming on the call this season. Thank you all so much for listening to the show. It's been an amazing, amazing season. Shout out to Melody Rowell, who produced this and all episodes. And of course, our friends over at Man Repeller, who published this amazing show. I cannot wait to talk to you next season. And even more so, I can't wait to see what you guys are doing in between the season, the calls that you're answering, the big things that you're doing in your lives. So make sure to hit me up online at Miss E. Will on Instagram, at Created by Erica on Twitter. And until then, y'all know what to do. Keep loving, keep fighting, keep dreaming, and above all, keep answering your call. Peace, y'all.